Good morning. Well, by the providence of God, I am still here. A few weeks ago, when my wife was nearing her due date, I said to her, you know, I would really love to preach the year of Jubilee on July 4th weekend. Wouldn't that be just a great fitting theme? Can you hold the baby in until then? And she kindly obliged. And then sometime last week, I started thinking, you know, it would be great if I could finish out this series in Leviticus before the baby comes. And wouldn't you know it, servant heart that my wife has, she agreed again. Strangely enough, this series in Leviticus has overlapped almost perfectly with our new baby. This is our 31st and final sermon in Leviticus today. And it's kind of weird to think about, but Janice became pregnant right about when we started this series. We had a few weeks off for holidays, coronavirus, other things. And now here we are finishing this series right before the birth of our fourth child. God works in mysterious ways. When I started this series, I wondered whether we'd see any fallout in attendance. I mean, it's not exactly the book of Revelation, you know. But this wasn't as bad as I expected. I mean, we managed to go from 350 a week to 150 a week. Or if you want to look at the bright side of things, we went from one service to two services. I prefer to think of it like that. But as I told you, when we began this series, it was really a warm-up to the book of Hebrews, an extended introduction to the book of Hebrews. But really, I hope that you've seen it's been a whole lot more than just that. It's a warm-up to the entire Bible, the Old and New Testament. The more you study these sacrifices and offerings, the more you study the clean and unclean laws, the more you consider the topic of holiness and the dwelling of a holy God among a sinful man, the more the Bible comes alive in other parts. We have seen woven throughout the pages of this book the roots of atonement, sacrifice, holiness, love and wrath and mercy of God. This book provides the light upon which we read the rest of Scripture. Without it, we would be reading in darkness, ignorant to the cultic context of the Leviticus and the Israelites. So today we read the final chapter, Leviticus chapter 27, laws about vows. When I think about vows, I always think of my wedding vows. On June 1st, 2007, Janice and I stood before a group of a couple hundred friends and family and church members, and we publicly declared our commitment to each other until death do us part. And the reason that in weddings we have so many witnesses there, the reason we spend so much on a grand ceremony, dressing up in tuxedos and dresses, eating fancy food, celebrating in a special place. The reason we do all of that is because the wedding vow is no small vow. It's the most important vow you'll ever make. We make it before God and man. We keep it or break it before God and man. In the Bible times, making a vow, not just a wedding vow, but any vow is a serious thing. Whether it was a vow to marry or more likely a vow to do something, to sacrifice something, to give something to God, vows were not taken lightly. The book of Deuteronomy says in chapter 23, if you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. You shall be careful to do what has passed your lips, for you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. And you can see how important it was to God that you kept your vow. Your word is an extension of your character. If you break your word, what does that say about your character? So God encourages them. You don't have to make a special vow. That's not a requirement. But if you do make a vow or a promise, keep it. Whatever you do, don't break it. In fact, this whole chapter of Leviticus 27 is really not so much about making vows. This whole chapter was about breaking vows and the penalties that come with breaking those vows. And what we'll see is, like all chapters in Leviticus, this has special relevance for the people of God even today. So if you will allow it, this ancient chapter of Scripture will speak to your heart and change your life. Let's begin with the first eight verses of Leviticus 27. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, if anyone makes a special vow to the Lord involving the valuation of persons, then the valuation of a male from 20 years old and up to 60 years old shall be 50 shekels of silver, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. If the person is a female, the valuation shall be 30 shekels. If the person is from 5 years old and up to 20 years old, the valuation shall be for a male 20 shekels and for a female 10 shekels. If the person is from a month old up to 5 years old, the valuation shall be for a male 5 shekels of silver, and for a female, the valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. And if the person is 60 years old or over, then the valuation for a male shall be 15 shekels, and for a female, 10 shekels. And if someone is too poor to pay the valuation, then he shall be made to stand before the priest, and the priest shall value him. The priest shall value him according to what the vower can afford. So verse 2 tells us that this passage deals with anyone making a special vow to God involving a person. Now, what exactly does that mean? How do you vow something involving a person? Well, I'll let the Bible illustrate it for us. If you've ever read the book of 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel begins with marital problems. There's a guy named Elkanah. He had 2 wives, Hannah and Peninnah. Peninnah had a lot of kids, and she went on to run a very successful chain of restaurants called Peninnah Bread. Now, of course, that made Hannah very jealous. Hannah went to the tabernacle. She cried out to God because of her barren womb. And here's what Hannah prayed. 1 Samuel 1:11. And she vowed a vow. Notice that language. She vowed a vow and she said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life and no razor shall touch his head. So Hannah vows a vow. And her vow involved her future son. She promised that if God would give her a son, she would dedicate him to the Lord, and no razor shall touch his head, which might mean that he might be raised a Nazarite. Nazarites were individuals who devoted themselves to the Lord by not cutting their hair, by not eating anything that came from the vine, so grape juice, wine, grapes themselves, not touching any dead bodies, and they would do this for a season of their life. Hannah says, if you will let me have a son, I'll give him to you forever, his whole life. So God grants Hannah's prayer and gives her a son. And after she weans baby Samuel, she drops him off at the temple so he could serve God. She made a special vow to the Lord involving a person. Now let's play a game called What If. What if Hannah had baby Samuel, and upon looking into his cute little baby eyes and pinching those cute little baby cheeks, she said, I think I really want to keep him. Could she do that? Well, the answer to that question is what Leviticus 27 is all about. If you make a vow to God involving a person, how much is that vow worth if you want to buy it back, if you want to redeem that vow? And in verses 3 to 7, God gives a basic layout of that answer. If your vow involved a person, here's a nifty chart I made to help organize the data. So according to this, if Hannah decided after a month that she wanted to keep baby Samuel, since Samuel was a male between a month old and 5 years old, his valuation would have been how many shekels? 5. Good. You're awake. Excellent. Hannah would have had to pay 5 shekels to redeem her vow. Another biblical example of this is Jephthah. In Judges 11, Jephthah makes a foolish vow to sacrifice the first thing that walks out of his house if he wins the battle that God already told him he would win. And when he gets home from that victory, what's the first thing that walks out of his house? His daughter. We don't know how old his daughter was, but we could probably be safe to assume she was between 5 and 20 years old since she was unmarried. If Jephthah wanted to redeem his foolish vow, according to this chart, what would he have to pay to the sanctuary? 10 shekels, which leads us to ask 2 questions. Number 1, how much is a shekel? And number 2, what in the world were you thinking, Jephthah? A shekel is not a coin. At the time that this was written, they didn't use coinage yet. A shekel is a unit of weight, about 2/5 of an ounce of silver. Well, how much was that worth back then? Well, here's what might surprise you. The average wage of a worker in those times was a shekel per month. So when we see a 30-year-old adult male and it was 50 shekels, to buy back, to redeem. We're talking about 4 years of average salary if you wanted to go back on that vow. An Israelite might have had options to pay in installments, but that is still a lot of money. And again, this stresses the seriousness of the vow. Don't make them with haste because they were very pricey to break. Now, about Jephthah, you might think, well, boy, now I get it. 10 shekels, that's almost a year's salary. No wonder why he didn't buy back his daughter from death. Well, first of all, I'd gladly give a year's salary if it meant my daughter could live. But second, Jephthah, we have to remember, at this point was leader over all Gilead. He just kicked butt in a battle, which means he undoubtedly had a lot of booty with him. I highly doubt he didn't have the money, which means, A, he either loved money more than he loved his kid, or B, Israel was in such bad shape theologically and morally that no one knew to look at Leviticus 27 and give him an out. And frankly, after reading the book of Judges, it's hard to tell which of those might be true. But anyway, this first paragraph gives us a breakdown of how much value to assign each individual who is vowed to God if you wanted to redeem that vow back. Immediately, you'll notice two things about this chart. The price goes down significantly for older and younger people. And second, the price goes down significantly for females as compared to males. Now, before we cry out sexist, ageist, let's keep something in mind. What would happen when a person was dedicated to the Lord? Where would they go? Well, Hannah dedicates Samuel to the Lord, and he goes to work in the tabernacle, right? He goes to work in the sanctuary. When you dedicated a person to the Lord, they would be put to work with the Levites, whether that was on the land that they owned, that he could till that land and work the land, or maybe a worker in the actual sanctuary like Samuel. But there was a lot of heavy lifting involved, handling big, bulky cattle, moving heavy sacks of grain. And generally, females are a lot less strong physically than males. Generally, really young people and really old people are less physically strong than people in the prime of their life. So these valuations reflected the relative productive capacity of an individual. A 30-year-old male can do harder work than a 65-year-old female, generally speaking. And I know we have some pretty tough grandmas out there, so I'm not looking to insult anyone this morning. As one commentator put it, to put it in blunt modern terms, a tractor that can harvest 50 acres a day simply costs more than a tractor that can harvest 30 acres a day. If you don't mind being compared to a tractor, I think that's a pretty good analogy. God takes vows seriously, but he graciously provides a way out if an individual needs to back out of a rash vow. Verse 8 even gives opportunity if the person who's making the vow is too poor. The priest would evaluate him and set the price according to what the guy could afford. Now, much of the rest of this chapter takes these same principles and applies them to other kinds of things that Israelites could vow. Verses 9 to 13 talk about what happens when you vow an animal to God, then want it back. It says, if the vow is an animal that may be offered as an offering to the Lord, all of it that he gives to the Lord is holy. He shall not exchange it or make substitution for it, good for bad or bad for good. If he does in fact substitute one animal for another, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. And if it is any unclean animal, then that may not be offered as an offering to the Lord, then he shall stand the animal before the priest, and the priest shall value it as either good or bad. And the priest, as the priest values it, so it shall be. But if he wishes to redeem it, he shall add a fifth to the valuation. So here's how it works for animals. Maybe God has given you an abundance of livestock, and your cows are giving birth to a lot of baby cows this year. Maybe you make a vow to the Lord as they're doing so. The next bull that I get in the litter, I will dedicate it to you, God. Well, but then, for whatever reason, that bull comes out, and you really want to keep that bull. Because a bull is a sacrificial animal, this text tells us that once you made that vow, there was no redeeming it from God. It was holy to the Lord. You've already dedicated it to him on his altar. You weren't allowed to exchange it for a lesser animal. Once you made that vow for a sacrificial animal, there was no exchange or substitution allowed. That's what the prophet Malachi accused the people of doing in his book. He writes in Malachi 1:14, cursed be the cheat who has a male in his flock and vows it, and yet sacrifices to the Lord what is blemished. For I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts, and my name will be feared among the nations. So don't promise God something great and then give him something much less. He is the great king, and he deserves much better than that. If you tried to substitute an animal and you got caught, then both that animal and the substitute became holy and was given to the Lord. Now, that text we read says that you can vow an unclean animal, a non-sacrificial animal, like a donkey. Priests rode on donkey. They could be beneficial for the Levites and for the priests there. If you want to buy it back, though, a priest would evaluate the animal. He would set a price, and then you'd have to pay that price plus a fifth. So if the priest said that donkey is worth $100, then you would have to pay $120 to the tabernacle to get your donkey back. But you'd have your donkey, they'd have $120, so win-win. So even with animals, people were encouraged to slow down and not make foolish vows. There is a price to pay if we do. We have a tendency as humans to make rash vows, don't we? Lord, if you will get me out of debt, I'll never buy another lottery ticket again. Yeah, right. I mean, as soon as you have money in your wallet again, that vow goes out the window. Lord, if you get me through this heart surgery, I promise never to eat fast food in my life again. Yeah, right. First time you drive past the Golden Arches and you smell those fries cooking, it's all over. We tend to make hasty vows, but better to keep your mouth shut and say nothing at all than to say something and break your word, because your word is an extension of your character. Now, verses 14 and 15 talk about people who vow their entire house to God. Let's read that. When a man dedicates his house as a holy gift to the Lord, the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so it shall stand. And if the donor wishes to redeem his house, he shall add a fifth to the valuation price, and it shall be his. So a house works the same as an unclean animal. The priest comes and he inspects the house. He decides if it's good or bad, which means he decides how much that the market value for that house is. And if the person wishes to redeem his house, to buy it back, he has to pay an additional 20%. Now, these priests were pretty versatile, weren't they? You always imagine them just as living in the tabernacle, doing tabernacle things. But Leviticus shows us that they had to be able to appraise cattle, to be real estate agents, to be house inspectors, not to mention all the other things that we've seen in this book. We've read months ago, like inspecting fungus outbreaks and weird skin diseases and all that. It was quite the job to be a priest back then, wasn't it? Well, the next paragraph continues along those same lines, but this time extends from the house to the entire property. Verse 16 to 25. If a man dedicates to the Lord part of the land that is his possession, then the valuation shall be in proportion to its seed. A homer of barley seed shall be valued at 50 shekels of silver. If he dedicates his field from the year of Jubilee, the valuation shall stand. But if he dedicates his field after the Jubilee, then the priest shall calculate the price according to the years that remain until the year of Jubilee. And a deduction shall be made from the valuation. And if he who dedicates the field wishes to redeem it, then he shall add a fifth to its valuation price, and it shall remain his. But if he does not wish to redeem the field, or if he has sold the field to another man, it shall not be redeemed anymore. But the field, when it is released in the Jubilee, shall be a holy gift to the Lord, like a field that has been devoted. The priest shall be in possession of it. If he dedicates to the Lord a field that he has bought, which is not part of his possession, then the priest shall calculate the amount of the valuation for it up to the year of Jubilee, and the man shall give the valuation on that day as a holy gift to the Lord. In the year of Jubilee, the field shall return to him from whom it was bought, to whom the land belongs as a possession. Every valuation shall be according to the shekel of the sanctuary. 20 gerahs shall make a shekel. A gerah was the smallest unit of money back in Old Testament times. So the same principle applies here, though. Notice how this paragraph combines principles from this chapter and principles from the chapter on the year of Jubilee. If an Israelite dedicated a land to the tabernacle or to the priests, the priest would value the land in proportion to its size and how much seed it could yield. So a homer of barley seed would be 50 shekels of silver. A homer is like between 4 to 6 bushels, or about up to 50 gallons or so. That's quite a bit. If the person wanted to redeem that land later on, the priest would have to take into account the year of Jubilee, deduct the appropriate value. They would again add a fifth to the value for the person to buy it back. And this chapter gives a few exceptions to this as well. If someone dedicates a field to God, then the priest sells it. Well, the field can't be redeemed at that point. The original owner can't buy it back. Come Jubilee, the field reverts back to the priest, not the original owner. If you purchase a field from an owner, then you decide to dedicate it to God. You can do that, but in the year of Jubilee, it doesn't go back to you. It reverts back to that original owner. So these laws are attempting to balance the principles of Jubilee with the principles at the beginning of this chapter. Now, it's not important that you walk out of here today remembering all these minor details about how much an Israelite's field was worth and how much it would have cost in gerahs and shekels and how much a 20-year-old female was worth in comparison to an unclean donkey. Those details, it's not important for you to remember all of that. I don't have those details memorized. I'm pretty sure it's not on the test to get into heaven. It's important, though, to get the big picture here. This whole chapter is all about this. Here, God, I want to give you something. Never mind, God, I want to take it back. Wishy-washy promises come with a price. They come with a price when you make them to your children, rather than just the God of the universe. You know how it is, parents. You promise your kids just about anything to make them go to bed, to quit getting them to quit bugging you, to make them get along. But those little promises so freely given have great impact on a child's trust in you. And in turn, their trust in God as well. Little by little, promise by promise, lie by lie, you can chip away at their trust in what you say, in who you are as a person, your character. And again, because you are supposed to represent God to your children, their trust in God is starting to erode as well. Wishy-washy promises come at a price when they relate to church ministry. Making a commitment to a ministry ought to be just that, a commitment. Your name on that nursery schedule means that other leaders, other parents, our kids, they all depend on you to show up and serve faithfully. Flaking out on a commitment has great impact, more impact than oftentimes we think about. And we get sick. We have emergencies come up. Life happens. But consider the principle from this text. You can go back on a promise, but it comes at a cost equal to or greater than that original promise. So I'd encourage you to think of it like this. Instead of, hey, Renee, I can't make it to nursery this morning. Good luck finding someone to replace me at last minute notice. Instead of that, try this. Hey, Renee, I can't make it to nursery this morning. I'm going to make some calls and make sure that someone can cover. And I'd be happy to fill in for whoever I find when it's their turn next month. Honor your promises, and when you can't, do your best to compensate for it. That's the principle of this text. Now, verses 26 and 27 take a little bit of a turn. They speak about the firstborn. Remember, the firstborn male belonged to the Lord. We learned that principle earlier in Leviticus. The firstborn male animal would be given as an offering or as a sacrifice. The firstborn male child would require Israelites to pay a tax in exchange for that kid. Keeping in mind, this will help us to understand these two verses, 26 and 27. It says, but a firstborn of animals, which as firstborn belongs to the Lord, no man may dedicate, whether ox or sheep, it is the Lord's. And if it is an unclean animal, then he shall buy it back at the valuation and add a fifth to it. Or if it is not redeemed, it shall be sold at the valuation. So the firstborn already belongs to God. That's what we start by hearing. An Israelite wasn't allowed to make a special vow to God for the firstborn sheep because it was already God's. It's like when your kid wraps something that you already own and gives it to you for your birthday. It's already yours. That's not a special gift. The thought doesn't count, kid. Go buy me something I don't have. I once had an employer give me a laptop when I joined, and they gave it to me with these words. This is your personal laptop. If you leave tomorrow, you take it with you. And then after a long time, when I left, they said, as a gift to you, we're going to let you take your laptop with you. Gee, thanks so much, right? The firstborn belongs to God. Verse 27 says that if it's an unclean animal, meaning that an animal that they could eat or sacrifice, they could not eat or sacrifice, you could redeem it by adding a fifth of its value and paying the priest. Now, the next two verses change it up a little bit again. Take a look, verses 28 and 29. It says, but no devoted thing that a man devotes to the Lord or anything that he has, whether man or beast or of his inherited field, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy to the Lord. No one devoted who is to be devoted for destruction from mankind shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. Now, this little paragraph might be best illustrated with another story from the Bible. Fast forward 40 years from the time that we're reading right now, 40 years from Mount Sinai. Moses is dead. Aaron is dead. The entire first generation of Israelites are all dead, save Joshua and Caleb. Joshua leads the people into the promised land. Their first stop is a place called Jericho. God has a unique way of having Israel conquer Jericho. For 6 days, the Israelites march once around the city, carrying the Ark of the Covenant with them. And then on the seventh day, here's what happens. Look in your Bibles at Joshua chapter 6, starting with verse 15. This will be on the screen. I'd encourage you to turn there because it's a lengthy passage. Joshua 6, starting in verse 15. It says, on the seventh day, they rose early at the dawn of day, and they marched around the city in the same manner seven times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city seven times. And at the seventh time, when the priest had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in their house shall live, because she has hid the messengers whom we sent. But you, keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction. Lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all silver and gold, every vessel of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout and the wall fell down flat. So the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Then they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys with the edge of the sword. Now, this text uses that phrase, devoted to destruction, several times. You've heard that here, and you hear it in Leviticus. The Hebrew word behind that is cherem, cherem. It means to be devoted or to devoted to destruction. We see that concept used in two main ways in this passage. When people or animals are cherem, they are devoted to God in the sense that they are killed, entirely destroyed. No one is taken captive in Jericho. No one is made a slave or a wife or a concubine. They are all killed. But the silver and gold, here's the second way that's used, the silver and gold and expensive stuff is devoted to God in the sanctuary. It's devoted to God not in the sense that it's destroyed, but it's given to the Lord's sanctuary. It goes to the tabernacle. So cherem is a biblical concept, which could mean devoted to utter annihilation or devoted to God's sanctuary. Either way, whatever's devoted is exclusively God's. You might remember that in the next chapter of Joshua, it's revealed that Achan broke this law and took some of the valuables and hid them beneath his tent. The Israelites, they lose in battle next, and they find out it's all Achan's fault, and he and his family are now cherem. They are put to death. They are given to God in utter destruction. So the principle that we see here in Leviticus 27 is that no cherem thing, no thing fully devoted to God, whether through destruction or through dedication, nothing cherem could be redeemed. Achan was not allowed to pay a price and keep some of the devoted stuff in Jericho. Joshua was not allowed to pay a price and take a wife from the Jerichoans, what do you call them? Jerichoanians. Things that are God's alone. That's the idea here. Some things God says, give that to me, and it is entirely mine, not yours to be redeemed. Which brings us to this next paragraph. Verse 30. Every tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the trees, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. If a man wishes to redeem some of his tithe, he shall add a fifth to it. And every tithe of herds and flocks, every tenth animal of all that pass under the herdsman's staff, shall be holy to the Lord. One shall not differentiate between good or bad, neither shall he make a substitute for it. And if he does substitute for it, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. This law regulates the tithe. What does tithe mean? Tithe literally means a tenth. It's a tenth of all that you own. For the Israelites, they didn't count their net worth based on what was in the bank. They didn't have banks back then. Sheep were valuable. Oxen, goats, grain, land. That's how they determined finances. If you were rich, you had a lot of stuff. Each year, as the crops came up, the Israelites would dedicate at least one-tenth of it to God, which meant they would bring a tenth to the tabernacle and give it to the priests. They would do the same with their cattle or their livestock. They would count them off as they passed underneath the shepherd's staff, one by one, and every tenth animal that passed under that staff would be selected to be a tithe to God. They weren't allowed to say, oh, not lamb chop. I want to keep lamb chop. Even though lamb chop was number 10, I'm going to keep her. Let's substitute Sally the sheep for lamb chop. No substitutes were allowed. The tenth animal, no matter what animal that was, good or bad, that animal was taken and given to God. If the Israelites wanted to give lamb chop bad enough, or keep lamb chop, I should say, he could pay for it, but it would cost that normal 120%. This would be taken as a tithe each and every year for the Israelites. Other passages show that there were several other kinds of tithes throughout the year, or every 3 years. So it's actually a little bit more than a tenth that Israelites would give when you considered it all together. But what about us? Are Christians commanded to tithe 10% of their earnings to God? And the answer is yes and no. Remember, the tithe was part of the Old Testament law, and the Old Testament was entirely fulfilled in Jesus Christ. We are no longer under this law. Sometimes the New Testament renews a law. Sometimes it changes or modifies a law. And in the case of the tithe, we do not see the command to tithe anywhere in the New Testament. We are not commanded to give 10% to the church. But what the New Testament does is it takes that law of the tithe and modifies it. Instead of commanding to give a flat 10% to God, the New Testament says we are to give proportionately to what God has given us. Which means if you're raking in $1 million a year, you could most certainly give 10% and more than that to the church. If you're making what the average Joe makes out there, 10% might be all that you could afford. But the New Testament gives us these principles of giving. New Testament commands us to give systematically or regularly. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16:2, on the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so that there will be no collecting when I come. Notice how he squeezes in that phrase, as he may prosper. So we do it regularly, systematically, each Sunday, each first day of the week, and it is done as you may prosper. So as God has blessed you, so you bless the Lord with what God has given you. It'll look differently for each person depending on how much you have. The New Testament giving says we should give cheerfully, willingly, not begrudgingly. 2 Corinthians 9:7, Paul says, each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Walter Kaiser writes, if a tenth was the minimum amount under the law, how can Christians do anything less? Because giving is such a big part of worship, we try to remind you of some of these things and principles regularly before we take offering each week. If you've never given to church before, or perhaps you haven't developed the discipline of regular giving, I'd encourage you to start somewhere today. As Paul writes, decide in your heart what to give and give with great joy because you know it's a blessing to God and it honors God with what he's given you. Start somewhere. Start with something each week or each month. Get into the habit. Increase it as you're able, as God blesses you. You might find that there is great joy in giving. One of the nice things about online giving that we have here is that you can set it up to give automatically, weekly or monthly. It helps with the discipline if you're new to it. My preference personally is to set a minimum amount each month, and then each month consider what God has given us above and beyond that minimum, above and beyond what we've expected to come in. And then we see how we could use some of that to honor God and bless others. But the point of this and the point of this whole chapter is to remind Israelites, holy people, keep promises and give faithfully. Vows and tithes. That's what this is all about. As James says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. God is holy and God keeps his word. We should be holy like him and we should keep our word as well. And that brings us to the last verse of the book of Leviticus, the grand conclusion to this great book, verse 34. These are the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. One last reminder that these commandments were given by God himself, given by God to his people through Moses. When we step back and we consider all these laws in total, they could be a little overwhelming. We've seen laws about offerings and sacrifices, laws for priests, laws for leaders, laws about clean and unclean food, childbirth, fungus, skin disease, laws about sex and blood and atonement and what kind of clothes to wear and how to trim your beard and how to treat your neighbor and how to manage your finances. And it goes on and on and on. And all of these laws, all of them, Leviticus says, were from God. We saw that they are all still applicable in some way to Christians. But we have to ask, could the Israelites have really kept all of these laws themselves? I mean, after all, remember our theme verse for this book. Be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Can we really be holy like God? When we look at all these laws, can we really keep all these laws straight? Above all, here is what we must remember. Yes, these are laws from God. Yes, he does hold us to a high standard, a divine, a perfect standard. But his grace is evident throughout all of this. 1 Peter 3:18, Peter writes, "For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God." It did not take God by surprise that the Israelites failed miserably to keep the law of Leviticus. In fact, part of God's plan all along was to send Jesus Christ to die for you, for his people, to offer a way of salvation into fellowship with God, to offer a way to walk and to dwell with a holy God once again. He knew we couldn't keep this, but he knew he could. And that's why he came to live a perfectly righteous life and die on the cross innocently, that his righteousness might be our own, that his holiness might be imparted to you, and that the wrath of God may be taken off of you, sinner. Putting our faith in God instead of our ability to keep his commands, that is what saves us. The righteous dying for the unrighteous. As we look forward to the book of Hebrews, which fills out our understanding of how Christ is greater than the law, and Christ is what the entire law points to, what I'd like to do is I'd like to close this series with a reading from Hebrews chapter 9. And then we're going to stand together, and we're going to sing our theme song for this book, Holy, Holy, Holy. And we're going to keep in mind, he is holy. He has asked us to be holy, but we can only do that through the blood of Jesus Christ and the power of the Spirit of God. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 11 and 12. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by the means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. All of Leviticus points forward to that, to Jesus Christ. Stand with me as we sing to our holy God.